Ukraine is militarily defeated. Anyone who looks deeply into the subject understands that the losses on the Ukrainian side are horrific. They really can't man the defenses on the perimeter of the Russian forces. Their energy grid is destroyed. Their electrical grid is destroyed. I think Ukraine is a defeated nation state. Russia knows it's winning, knows it's effectively won. Russia wants to end the war, but it wants to end the war with someone on the other side who is competent and trustworthy. Now you have Macron, who seems to think that he's a combination of Richelieu and Talleyrand, and he's going to go to Moscow and negotiate with the Russians. Well, Russians will talk to him, but I don't see any evidence that Macron can deliver on anything. And then you have Merz. The Russians, and frankly, all of us in the United States are shaking our heads at this sort of suicidal path Germany is on to deindustrialize. And then there's Great Britain. And anyone who thinks that Starmer can deliver on very much is deluded, because the population hates and despises him. And Trump basically said this to my face in 2020, said the Europeans have to be their own first, you know, responders. They have to be first on the battlefield. They have to fight. We can support, we can assist, but we can't be the primary keystone, if you will, in this arch of security.
In other words, this war is more dangerous, more likely to escalate than ever before.
Yes.
Grüezi miteinander. Ich begrüße Sie ganz herzlich zu einer weiteren Ausgabe von Weltwoche Daily Spezial. Mein Name ist Roman Zeller und heute bei uns in der Gast ist ein Ihnen vielleicht bekanntes Gesicht, Colonel Douglas MacGregor. Und nun wechsle ich auf Englisch. Thank you very much, Colonel. I welcome you to this show. Thank you very much for taking your time. In a couple of days, we're having 4 years of war in Ukraine. From your point of perspective, what's the current stand in this war in Ukraine? How would you assess the situation in Ukraine?
Well, Ukraine is militarily defeated. Only people that listen exclusively to state-sponsored news in places like Germany, France, or England think otherwise. Mm-hmm. Anyone who looks deeply into the subject understands that the losses on the Ukrainian side are horrific. I would say that for most of the war, for every one Russian, you had five or six Ukrainians killed or wounded. I think it then rose to 9 or 10. And at this point, I think the ratio may even be higher, because the Ukrainians no longer have any viable air and missile defense. They really can't man the defenses on the perimeter of the Russian forces. Their energy grid is destroyed. Their electrical grid is destroyed. I think Ukraine is a defeated nation state. In fact, some of us are wondering whether or not the Ukrainian nation state will even survive this experience. And that's the most depressing aspect of this whole thing, because of the unwillingness in Washington and in European capitals to come to terms with reality on the ground in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. We have spent lives there without a second thought, and destroyed a society and a country in the process. And we ourselves have sacrificed enormous amounts of equipment and money, but we haven't really paid the price on the battlefield. That's been exacted from the Ukrainian people. Mm-hmm. Russia knows it's winning, knows it's effectively won. Russia wants to end the war, but it wants to end the war with someone on the other side who is competent and trustworthy. Mm-hmm. That's a very difficult process right now, which is why nothing has changed dramatically.
Mm-hmm. If you listen to Western politicians, especially to European politicians, they're still willing to support Ukraine. They're still willing to fight, to keep on that battle. Is there any weapon, any amount of money that could be spent, that could be given to the Ukrainians that could turn around the situation on the battlefield, in your view?
No, not at all. I see no evidence for that at all. Mm-hmm. But we also have to keep in mind that a lot of this money that was spent on equipment and aid for Ukraine ended up being recycled back into the pockets of people in the West. I mean, that's very clear on the Hill. In fact, there's an investigation underway. I don't know if it'll gain much traction, where they're tracking millions of dollars into the bank accounts of senators and congressmen who've been in the forefront of urging conflict in Ukraine. It's a terrible racket, to be blunt. In the meantime, you know, the Ukrainians have paid the price. Mm-hmm. And I think if we had access, and I think we've had modest access, there's a German journalist whose name escapes me right now, who's been in Western Ukraine, that is on the west side of the Dnieper River. And his informal polling suggests that everyone there wants an end to the war. And many people say, look, we've got to have peace with Russia. If that means the Russians have to come here and station forces, we're ready for it because we cannot sacrifice any more life. And I don't think we should be surprised by that. And I don't think that that has to happen as a solution. But it reflects reality. And that reality, I don't think, is going to make it to the Munich Security Conference. I think when that is held, we're going to be listening to the same delusional rhetoric that we've heard for 4 years. The globalist class that rules Europe, for that matter, the globalist class in Washington, D.C., that rules us, will not let go of this war. They cling desperately to the notion that Russia is weak. Russia has been harmed. Don't stop now. I mean, these are the things that we hear all the time. China is weak. It's on the verge of collapse. It's going to go into recession. There will be millions of people that will overthrow the government. You ask yourself, what planet are these people living on? And it's hard to believe they're on planet Earth because most of what they believe inside the Beltway, and I think this is true in Paris, London, and Berlin, are simply nonsense. It's not real. So I don't know how you deal with that. And I think that's the question for Moscow right now.
Kurze Werbeunterbrechung. Wer kritisch denkt, soll auch kritisch wählen beim Smartphone und Tablet. Das Volaphone Quintus mit Vola OS verzichtet konsequent auf digitale Bevormundung. Kein Konto, mehr Souveränität, weniger Ablenkung. Vola ist eine innovative Alternative zum Smartphone und Tablet. Mainstream, frei und unabhängig. Mehr Informationen finden Sie unter vola.online. Ich wiederhole, vola.online, und Leser der Weltwoche erhalten auf alle Smartphones und Tablet einen exklusiven Rabatt von 5% mit dem Rabattcode Weltwoche5. Ich wiederhole, Weltwoche5. How strong or how weak, as you named it, is Russia in your point of view, militarily spoken? How weak or how strong is Russia?
I think Russia is stronger now than it's been since the 1980s. They have 1.3 million men under arms in the army alone. They build up their air and missile force dramatically. Everything that people said about Russia in January and February of 2022, in terms of strength and power and capability, exists today. Didn't exist then. I mean, initially, when the Russians went in, they completely misjudged the situation. Their force was really small on the ground and was designed for border security. They marched into what was obviously a huge ambush by a 400,000 or 500,000 man force, equipped, trained by NATO, primarily by the US, the British, to a lesser extent, the Germans. And then guided throughout the entire period by NATO and the NATO military command structure, which goes all the way to SHAPE, Supreme Headquarters Allied Powers Europe. The Russians discovered that they had misjudged. They didn't expect what they found. And so they made a decision by June to go over to the strategic defensive, which they did under General Surovikin, who is now spending most of his time in Africa. An Air Force general, and he put together this brilliant defense. That defense worked. It was a defense that could not be broken by anything that was done in the West. And if you go back to 2023, 2024, you keep hearing people say, well, another 400 tanks, another 500 armored fighting vehicles, another 600 artillery pieces, and that's what we need, and we'll be able to finally break through and win and so forth. And the Russians simply bled the Ukrainians. And stupidly, we kept encouraging them to attack and try to penetrate what could not be penetrated. It's failed miserably. The graveyards are full. In fact, someone said to me the other day, Ukraine is now a graveyard with flags. That's how terrible it is. And we keep hearing these lies. Well, the Russians have lost hundreds of thousands, million men. That's all nonsense. We only know roughly what figures are because no one is telling the truth. But as I said before, somewhere between 1.5 and 1.8 million Ukrainian soldiers have died. And is anyone surprised that desertions are way up, that people are fighting off the press gangs that are coming to take their men, No, no one should be surprised at all. And then on top of that, you have the terrible medical care. I mean, the Russians have put together a very effective medical evacuation system. Soldiers, most of the time, 80% of them recover from wounds and return to combat. Almost nobody returns to combat on the Ukrainian side. And you see, instead of good medical care and efficient medical care, desperate measures involving the elimination of legs and arms and so forth to keep people alive have been adopted. It's a disaster. It's a human tragedy. And there's also a failure to understand that from the very beginning, President Putin has said over and over and over again, these people are, after all, Ukrainian Orthodox Christian Slavs. We're not interested in killing Ukrainian Orthodox Christian Slavs. If we didn't care how many people we killed, we would have handled this war very differently. So then that brings you to Europe. And he's tried to tell the Europeans, if you intervene in this, we will treat you the way we have not treated the Ukrainians. There will be no more restraint exercised in any way. And I think he's frustrated because he was hoping he would end up with some European partners that could talk to him. Now you have Macron, who seems to think that he's a combination of Richelieu and Talleyrand, and he's going to go to Moscow and negotiate with the Russians. Well, the Russians will talk to him, but I don't see any evidence that Macron can deliver on anything. And then you have Merz, the Russians, and I, frankly, all of us in the United States are shaking our heads at this sort of suicidal path Germany is on to deindustrialize. And then there's Great Britain. And anyone who thinks that Starmer can deliver on very much is deluded because the population hates and despises him. Europe is that, to quote de Tocqueville, who wrote a book about the United States in the 1840s, de Tocqueville described the situation in France in 1848 as the equivalent of sleeping on the slopes of a volcano. Of course, we know we had the revolutions of 1848. Well, I think that's what Europe is in the midst of right now. As things grow worse economically, financially, the internal problems dealing with millions and millions of people that really weren't invited and can never become Europeans and never will be Europeans. If anything, they're there to transform everybody else into what they want. That's not going to work. So I think all of this is going to collapse, but I don't think you're going to see any admission of these facts at the Munich Security Conference. And then at the same time, people are shocked. We now have general officers, American general officers, being removed from the European structure of NATO. Of course, President Trump, and basically said this to my face in 2020, said Europeans have to be their own first, responders. In other words, they have to be first on the battlefield. They have to fight. We can support, we can assist, but we can't be the primary keystone, if you will, in this arch of security. We live thousands of miles away. It's back to de Gaulle, kept saying over and over again to everybody, Americans don't live in Europe. Britain is an island. No one would listen, but he's right. And that's what Trump has tried to say. Now the Europeans are bitter and angry. They're attacking the United States. But that's what you would expect from Donald Trump. He's simply stating the facts. We can't be there. We cannot be there forever. That's what Vice President Vance said. And remember, you have Merkel back in 2017. She made a speech and she said, well, it's obvious we can't rely on the Americans anymore, as though we were the permanent godfathers of everyone in Europe. It's absurd. And she said, we have to find our own way forward. Well, what did she do? Nothing. Macron said, NATO is brain dead. We need new ideas. What happened? Nothing. I mean, Europeans are in a terrible position, but they're going to have to get themselves out. But that means also admitting the Russians are not coming. They're not going to attack Europe. They're not interested.
What is from 4 years of this war? What's your resume? What's the most important insight? What does this war in Ukraine stand for after 4 years?
Well, in January of 2022, I was interviewed, I think, by Dmitry Symes, who's now in Moscow. He at the time was with the National Interest. And he asked several of us, what do you think ultimately happens as a result of this war? And I immediately said, the disintegration of NATO. NATO will not stand up under this pressure. Everyone forgets that NATO was founded with an ostensibly defensive purpose in mind. It was not founded with the goal of attacking anyone. So that's number one. Number two, this NATO expansion was always done impulsively and haphazardly on the assumption, well, the Russians are weak. They complain, they'll do nothing. And sadly, I think the Kosovo air war seemed to demonstrate to everyone that the Russians were a paper tiger, that they could not intervene, they couldn't influence anything. You'll recall the Russians finally, because they simply didn't have the food and fuel to send to Serbia to get them through the winter, pulled their support from Serbia. And that's when the Serb military pulled out of Kosovo. And the Serbian military was in pristine condition. Their forces had performed very, very well. Very few of them had been killed. So it was not this massive bombing that drove them out. It was very simply a trip by a man, the deputy secretary or undersecretary, or excuse me, the deputy secretary of state, Strobe Talbot, who flew to Moscow behind closed doors, made promises. I don't know what they involved in terms of money, likely billions of dollars in support and assistance. And Yeltsin sat down and consulted with his inner circle, and he said, we can't support the Serbs. You know, we've got to pull support and tell the Serbs to cut the best deal they can get. That signaled to people in the West that Russia is weak. Russia can be bullied. And so there was no fear in terms of bringing in Poland, Slovakia, Hungary, the Baltic states, Romania, Bulgaria, and so forth, because they said, you know, the Russians paper tiger. And then behind this was another group of people in Washington, as well as in Paris, London, and I think in Berlin, who said, sure, let's push this. Let's go further. You know, ultimately, it's in our interest to remove the regime there, and we'll turn Russia into a globalist state. In other words, we'll go in there, we'll rape it for its resources, we'll divide it up, make it into smaller pieces, so forth. And that continued for many, many years. Then we get the coup in 2014 that changes everything after the Maidan business. And then we're off to the races. And all the time and money is spent between 2014 and 2022 building up this Ukrainian menace, convincing the Ukrainians that they could retake the Crimea, they could press into southern Russia, and ultimately bring down the regime because the Russian people never supported it and the Russians were weak. And then we watched as Russia rebuilt itself. It sprang back to life, rose like a phoenix from the ashes. Mm-hmm. So today, if you say, what's the most important thing? Number one, NATO is gone. Mm-hmm. I don't care what they say at the Munich Security Conference, it's over. NATO is going to fragment. The Europeans are going to have to develop their own security systems. And then secondly, Russia is now, for the first time since the dissolution of the Soviet state, is a real major power. Mm-hmm. Certainly on land, it has no peer. Mm-hmm. And that's something else that people don't understand right now. In Washington, we're cheering the seizure of tankers carrying oil from Russia. And the Russians have even flagged tankers, as we saw the one, I think it was the Marinara, that was flagged with the Russian flag. We paid no attention to that. We seized the tanker. Mm-hmm. The Russians saw it happen, and they have been struggling with what to do about it, because what we have done is something called horizontal escalation. We cannot match the Russians on the ground anywhere in Eurasia. If you try to match the Russians, you're going to lose if you're an American. We are a maritime and an aerospace power. So now we've gone to sea, and we're trying to maximize our advantage, strategic advantage at sea against Russia, which means we want to interrupt the flow of oil. This also has implications for China. And I think what happened is that President Trump, you know, came back and he said, well, you know, we can't do everything the Russians want. What can we do? And he is surrounded by people who are urging him to use the military for war purposes. Mm-hmm. The only thing people understand is the use of force, Mr. President. You've got to show those people in Moscow. You've got to show those mullahs in Tehran. You've got to show those Chinese in Beijing. They understand power. And so we see him go meet with Modi, and then he tries to bully Modi into backing away from Russia. Well, mm-hmm. to some extent, that's happened. Will that last? I don't know. But the point is, what the Chinese, the Indians, and the Russians have figured out, we're continental powers. Mm-hmm. They are now going to try and strangle us from the sea. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what's happening. So there is no interest in Washington in a real settlement with Russia. President Putin is probably the last man in Moscow, I think, at this point, who really believes there's hope. But if you listen to Lavrov, he points out they've made the sanctions worse, Mr. President. They're waging war against us economically and also at sea. What are we going to do? And you have people saying, well, we should intervene. We should stop this. The Chinese are watching this. They're very concerned. Now, we've been smart in one way. We have deliberately said we would not interrupt the flow to China. This is our brilliant strategy of separating Russia from China. I don't think that'll work, but I think that's what people have on their minds. So I see no backing away from military confrontation. On the contrary, it's getting worse. And now we're going to have a $1.5 trillion defense budget. I guess we call it now the war budget, which we might as well, because that's what we're doing.
So when I get you right, is we are far away from peace, even though Zelensky just said, according to the Financial Times, that he is willing to hold elections, willing to hold a referenda when it comes to a peace deal with Russia. You say we are far away from peace, right?
Well, who is going to trust Zelensky to hold elections that are, you know, going to be free and fair? Are we going to let the OSCE back into the business? I mean, they have supervised elections in the past. And in fact, if you go back to the last elections they supervised in Russia, I thought they did a very fine job and the outcomes were legitimate. I don't know if he'll permit that or not. I have my doubts. Remember, Ukraine is probably the most corrupt place in the world. It makes Mexico, you know, and Colombia look like pristine utopian societies compared with what happens in Ukraine. So I don't know that that's going to sit well with the Russians. The Russians would love to see it, but only if it's real. And who's going to guarantee that it's real? You know, then you go back to the Europeans and say, well, we'll send troops in. We'll guard these places. So it's just crazy nonsense.
Is there any chance for a peace deal? What would be a good peace deal for Ukraine? Is there a person that could negotiate a peace deal with Vladimir Putin in Russia? Is there any chance, Mr. McGregor?
If a team that consisted of professional diplomats, preferably people that have experience in the Department of State, you can have some people with experience in the Department of Defense as well, but I would look for a civilian contingent. In other words, I wouldn't drag any military officers with me, which unfortunately is what we're doing right now with Witkoff and Kushner. Witkoff and Kushner are the president's friends, and they're busy making deals on the sidelines to enrich themselves and the Trump family. That's a waste of time. And the Russians know what's going on, and they're disgusted by it, as are everybody else in the world that I can talk to outside of the United States. So you've got to have a truly representative team from the Department of State, to a lesser extent, Department of Defense. Then you have to go into the talks with the understanding that the only solution that can be acceptable, and I would argue that this is true for Europeans as well as Russians, is an Austrian solution for Ukraine. The Austrian state treaty is still the best model. Why is it such a good model? Because it worked. It worked very well. I mean, in recent years, I remember when I was in Germany 20 years ago, Germans started observing the fact that in Austria, the standard of living was beginning to rise above their own. And, you know, the Germans have always sort of spoken disparagingly about the Austrians, and the Austrians have talked disparagingly about the Germans. So it's just nothing new. We know that. But I think we have to understand that that is the only path forward. Now, if you're going to accept that, then you can begin looking at the territorial arrangements. And then also the backdrop to all of this is a desired security arrangement for Russia with its neighbors. In other words, if you're going to hold an exercise with troops, you know, let's get back to the business of informing people and having observers and looking at the limits on sizes and so forth. Europeans may regard that as silly or nonsensical. It's very important to the Russians, and they need to take this seriously. The Russians look at Ukraine as a very important strategic barrier, almost as a cordon sanitaire that has to exist to protect Russia. And if you challenge them on that, they'll say, well, look what's happened to us. Look at this giant army that you built in Ukraine that's taken us years to destroy. Look at this terrible regime, which is a puppet regime. We can't have that. Well, that means if you go to the Austrian state solution, the Russians or the Soviets at the time always had representation on the Austrian National Defense Council. Well, that made sense because the Russians were concerned about any kind of National Socialist revanchism or anything else. But that, in time, the Russians dropped that. It wasn't necessary. It was obvious that the Austrian neutrality was working. I think we have to take a similar approach with Ukraine, but we also have to go back and read. We used to have something called the Mutual Balanced Force Reduction Talks. We need to look at what we did there. We need to look at the agreements that were reached with OSCE. I'm talking about during the Cold War. Let's go back and look at those. Let's look at the proposals the Russians gave us in December 2021, because the heart of the whole thing was not Ukraine. They saw Ukraine as a symptom of something dangerous. In other words, encroachment on their territory. They wanted a different security arrangement so that they didn't have to worry about perpetually defending themselves in Ukraine. But the only way to get there is first and foremost, accept the Austrian state treaty solution. That has to happen.
Neutrality of Ukraine, is that right?
Yes.
All right. Would Vladimir Putin accept that? Would he trust the West? How do you assess Vladimir Putin's role at the moment? I think you mentioned correctly that the US is kind of trying to get involved with all the partners of Russia as well as China. I'm talking about India, Venezuela, Iran as well, probably. Is What, how would you say, how is Vladimir Putin reacting to all of that gambling from the US? What is his role at the moment? Maybe also his interest. How would you assess the president of Russia these days?
I think President Putin wants to narrow the focus for the moment to ending the conflict in Ukraine. And I think he's begun to realize that that will have to happen with the use of Russian military power. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean that the Russian forces advance to Dnipro and cross the river, move south and take Odessa? Does it mean that Russian forces in the northeastern portion now advance and seize Kharkov? And once they have control of Kharkov and Odessa, do they then turn towards the west, cross the river, and march into Kiev? I don't know. But I think we have to understand that those things are under serious consideration right now. There are many, many Russians who do not believe that any solution that does not involve de facto Russian control of at least those cities will not work. Now, I don't necessarily think that President Putin has reached that conclusion. And that's where there's some friction inside his government. If you listen to Mr. Lavrov, he's pointed out in his public statements just within the last few days, look at what these people have done. The Americans have doubled down on sanctions. Whatever we thought they agreed to in Anchorage is meaningless. You know, we don't want another Minsk agreement experience. We want real outcomes. We're not going to get them right now from the people in charge. And what Europeans need to understand is something that most Americans are only just now beginning to figure out. Trump has no strategy. President Trump hasn't studied anything. He doesn't read and study material. He has a very short attention span. And he tends to think, as someone who has been a deal maker in the real estate industry, that he can transfer those skills to the international system. That means that you are ignoring potentially interests. In other words, he says, well, Mr. Xi is a friend of mine. I know we can work this out. Yeah, I know Putin and we get along. That's all nonsense. That's meaningless. You know, most of the people that finally buried Napoleonic France and won the war privately all admired Napoleon's genius. No one disputed that, but he was a menace. So just because you admire someone or like them doesn't mean anything. What was everybody's interest in 1815 to end this nonsense? The problem is that Donald Trump doesn't understand interests. He doesn't understand Russia's legitimate security interests because he's told by everyone they have no legitimate security interests. That's outrageous. Of course they do, just as we do, you know. But that's the problem that President Trump has. So somebody walks in and says, I have an idea, boss. Let's use the big, beautiful fleet and go after these tankers, and that'll squeeze the Russians. Okay, good luck. I don't think the Russians are going to be squeezed. I don't think the Chinese are going to be squeezed. I don't even think the Indians will be squeezed. But what you risk when you do these kinds of things is a real war. And Americans don't understand what a real war is. They haven't had one for a very, very long time.
In other words, this war is more dangerous, more likely to escalate than ever before.
Yes, but not in the ways that everybody anticipated. Everyone thought, well, the Russians, they'll just flatten everything and march to the Polish border. They don't want to do it. That's the last thing they want to do. They want to secure what they think is necessary for their future security. That's where you negotiate. That's when you look at territorial issues and troop balances and so forth. But we have taken the initiative because we are the greatest maritime power in the world to take our war with Russia to sea. And we say, well, the Russians aren't going to challenge us at sea. That's a dangerous assumption because today, aircraft carriers look great on television. They're very inspiring to the American public, but they can be destroyed very easily by one well-placed submarine. And our anti-submarine capabilities are not very good. It's not because we're not trying. It's very difficult. And if you're going to go into the high seas, these nuclear-powered attack subs are almost impossible to detect. In fact, they are impossible to detect in the thermocline. In other words, in deep water. So it's a dangerous practice. And a lot of our wars as Americans have started with naval forces. That happened at Pearl Harbor. That wasn't the first time. The Gulf of Tonkin incident, which was fraudulent, but it started at sea, was reported by the Navy. That took us to war in Vietnam. My point is that that's what we are. We're not a great land power. We don't maintain large armies. We don't want to. They're expensive. And we've always seen them as somehow or another threatening from a purely social standpoint. Russia is a land power, but it does have a substantial submarine fleet. That submarine fleet is large enough to do a lot of damage. And if you do damage to us at sea, you're going to be at war with us. And that's why Mr. Putin thus far has taken no action. But how long do you stand by and tolerate this? I mean, that's the question. Here's President Putin, who wants nothing but good relations with Europe and the United States. He's largely given up on Europe, at least until there are new governments. In fact, someone interviewed Russian soldiers coming straight out of Ukraine just a month ago, several dozen of them, in a place called Mariupol. They were coming out after 6 months before they refreshed themselves and then were rotating back in after a month. And what they found when they interviewed these Russian soldiers, one after the other, is that they all believe that there is going to be a giant war between this, Russia, Moscow, and the Europeans. They believe that fervently. So the question was asked, well, what about America? Oh, no, the Americans don't want to fight us. And they said, what about President Trump? Oh, well, we like President Trump. We think he's a tough leader. Now, you can dismiss all that out of hand, but I think that in microcosm has been the view in Moscow for some time. And everything that Putin has done militarily on the ground, this very deliberate, methodical approach, is not just to spare Ukrainian lives, although that's always been in the uppermost in his mind, but also to spare his own soldiers. He doesn't want to waste Russian lives. And then finally, he didn't want to stir up the United States and NATO. He didn't want to give them a reason to suddenly mobilize and attack. Now, you and I know from our experience in Europe, there's nothing to mobilize. Recruitment stations in Germany are not overwhelmed with people signing up to fight in Russia. It's not going to happen. But he's not entirely convinced of that. And so the Russians think we're on the path to war with Europe. They just won't listen. They hate us. They've hated us for centuries. Then they start listing all the wars that they fought with everybody in Europe. That's what the soldiers think.
What's the positive? What's the glimpse of hope? Is there a politician that sees this potential of escalation? Is there someone that could de-escalate the situation? Do you see someone?
Well, I think President Orban has tried. But President Orban is the president of what, 8 million people in Hungary. So I don't think he can lead the charge. The Poles could assist in this, but they are almost incurably anti-Russian. I'd had high hopes for this president, Navrotsky, that he would step up to the plate and recognize that this needs to end and we need to negotiate an end to the conflict, but he hasn't. The ideal person for this is Donald Trump. But Donald Trump is a narcissist who's not going to sign for anything that doesn't make him a hero. He said, well, I can't do that. I had said repeatedly, pull the plug on Ukraine. You want this war to end? Stop funding it. Stop the equipment flow. Pull out all of our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines who are on the ground as technical supporters and contractors to help the Ukrainians. Get them out. Just tell the Europeans, that's it. We are out. And that would end the war because the Europeans are not going to come up with replacements for all of that. They can't come up with the money. They can't afford what they're doing right now. So why hasn't President Trump done that? Because he'll say, it makes us look like we lost. Well, we did. We backed the wrong horse in the wrong race. It's time for us to say, that's it. And he could go down in history as a peacemaker. He could get his Nobel Prize that he seems to want so desperately if he did what I just described. Recognize this must end, and the only way it can end is with the recognition that Russia has been victorious in its fight, and it's time for us to sit down, and the only way that's going to happen is if we get out. We get out of it completely. And stop and think for a second. We've never had any strategic interest throughout our entire history in a place called Ukraine. None.
I just wanted to ask you that. What's the main, what do you think? What's the interest of Donald Trump? What does he want at the moment in Ukraine? What is his goal, his interest in this war?
I think he wants to be hailed as a great hero and a victor in whatever happens. He wants to be the center of attention. He wants the glamorous photo shot that shows him as having brought the war to an end. But he went in there in Anchorage without really understanding what was going on. He didn't come with a viable proposal. There were discussions, and I think the Russians reached the conclusion that he's sincere, he wants to end the war. And then they left. And what did they discover? Well, whatever he said was meaningless. Donald Trump is still the prisoner of the Washington community. And the people that surround him, the people that paid for his election, that put him into office, they want to damage Russia. So you can't stop. You just have to keep on doing what you're doing, and eventually Russia will give up. And now we have to destroy Iran. And we have to do to Iran what we were unable to do to Russia. And then the world will be safe, specifically for Israel, as well as our strategic interests, because then we can control the oil and natural gas jugular in the Persian Gulf. And if we control that, we have China by the throat. Now, I think that's insane. It's nonsensical. This is the 21st century. This is not 1880. But the thinking is all pre-World War I thinking. It treats the world as though there are power blocks and you are jockeying for position and you always walk up to the edge of real war. Well, we know how that turned out. They finally crossed the Rubicon and ended up in a terrible war. No one is thinking that that's possible because, again, the underlying assumptions, oh, these Iranians, they're weak. They can't stop us. We can dominate them. Just as they said in February of 2022, oh, the Russians are weak. We can dominate them. They'll collapse in a few weeks once we impose sanctions. I had people in the government actually tell me at the time, Doug, you don't understand. We don't want a war. We just want to get to Russia, get them to knuckle down and do what we want. And we can do that. This will be over in a few months. They'll never, ever, ever withstand the economic sanctions. Well, here we are. That hasn't worked. I don't think it's going to work in Iran. Certainly not going to work on the Chinese. But this is the bubble he lives in. You've got to understand that. That's the bubble he lives in. Somebody like me is not admitted to the Oval Office. Forget it. Not getting in.
What actually happened to Mr. Rubio, the foreign minister? You mentioned Mr. Witkoff as well as Mr. Kushner. They are leading the talks with Russia. They are everywhere, all over the news. What actually happened to Mr. Rubio? Would he be a one that could de-escalate a little bit, or is he out of the game at the moment?
I think that Secretary Rubio is preeminently concerned with Latin America and the Caribbean. He was very much in the forefront of pushing intervention in Venezuela. We didn't intervene. We captured two people and declared victory. And the Venezuelans do not regard us as their conquerors. And they are not doing everything that we want them to do. And they're not going to. But I think Mr. Rubio's focused there, and he's focused on Cuba. We've now reinvigorated the old Cuban policy with the hopes of bringing down the government. So I suppose that Secretary Rubio can become the new viceroy of Cuba and the Caribbean. I don't think he's terribly interested in what happens in Europe. So he's going to go along with the status quo. There's not much difference between him and, let us say, Tony Blinken, the other previous Secretary of State. But I think he's also decided that the enterprise that Messrs. Witkoff and Kushner are engaged in isn't going to work. It's a dead end. And I don't think he wants to be tainted by that failure, because I think he aspires to become president in the future. And so if he can stand back and say, well, we did all we could, but it didn't work, it's not seen as his failure. Because after all, these people are friends of Donald.
What gives you hope that this war in Ukraine could soon be over? Is there any hope? What are the indicators that there will be peace soon? When will this war in Ukraine end?
Two things. I think we are going to attack Iran. I think that is a huge mistake. The notion that you can bomb Iran into the Stone Age, that it will disintegrate and collapse under the crushing weight of your bombings, I think is unrealistic. Iran will survive. Iran, in the meantime, is going to do an enormous amount of damage in the region, especially to Israel. How much damage they'll do to us is a question I can't answer. They certainly have the ability to do serious damage to us in the region. They can hit our bases. Could they target and try to strike ships at sea? Potentially. But the Navy's pretty good about sailing far, far away from the coast when it becomes clear that somebody can actually engage them. So I think the Iranian thing will not go well. When it doesn't go well, that actually creates an opportunity for the situation in Europe to change. But that will depend heavily on Europeans. And that's why I say I don't see Donald Trump stepping up as the leader of NATO and saying it's over. It's time for us to recognize the facts on the ground and come to an agreement. I don't see him doing that. It's not in his DNA to admit that. So I think he'll just gradually disengage. And I think that's already begun. The only thing that hasn't happened is the withdrawal of troops. So the Europeans, I think, are the ones that you have to turn to. Are there any statesmen in Europe anymore? I can't answer that.
I mean, we at least saw Mr. Merz admitting that Russia is a European country, as well as Macron that said he wants to keep or step into a dialogue with Russia. So there are at least some changes happening, right?
I think that's encouraging, and we'll have to wait and see. But that's the only thing that I can imagine happening is some sort of agreement reached by European leaders. And the thing that nobody ever bothers to point out, the key figures in all of this, Finland, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Poland, Slovakia, Hungary, Romania. Why are they key figures? Because they border Ukraine and Russia. All of those states have to come together to sign on for whatever agreement is reached. And I go back to the beginning, that agreement has to reflect the Austrian state treaty for Ukraine. I think it's attainable. I think it can be done. But can Macron lead Europe? I don't think so. Can Merz lead Europe? I mean, these people are globalists. They have ties to BlackRock and all these major financial firms that are part of the cabal under our friend George Soros, who's trying to destroy Europe through immigration. I don't know. I keep looking for somebody. The only one who's made the right noises is Orban. And he, from the very beginning, has warned against all this business. And he's always been right. Now, I'm not saying he's pristine, perfect, and the greatest man in the world, but he's a man of common sense and realism. Can we find somebody else in the West like that? Can we get anybody to sign on for an end to this tragedy? Somebody who thinks more about humanity than they do about themselves. But I wouldn't expect that kind of leadership out of Washington. Just don't see it.
Mr. McGregor, thank you very much for your time.
Oh, thank you.
Entschuldigen Sie, bevor Sie dieses Video nun wegklicken, was Sie eben gesehen haben, diese Art von Journalismus, die gibt es eigentlich in dieser Form fast nicht mehr auf dieser Welt. Rede und Gegenrede, die andere Sicht beleuchten, das ist die Weltwoche, unabhängig, kritisch und ja, auch gut gelaunt, weil wir eben glauben, dass selbst in den schlimmsten Abgründen immer irgendwo ein Lichtblick liegt. Wir beleuchten, was andere weglassen. Wir sprechen mit jenen, mit denen sich sonst niemand zu unterhalten getraut. Wir schreiben, was ist. Abonnieren Sie daher die Weltwoche. Jedes Abo ist eine Liebeserklärung an die Meinungsvielfalt. Denn unabhängiger Journalismus funktioniert eben nur mit unabhängig kritischen und vielleicht auch gut gelaunten Lesern. Sie sind der Grund, warum wir machen können, was wir eben machen. Alle Abo-Optionen finden Sie auf unserer Website www.weltwoche.de, sowohl für Print als auch digital und maßgeschneidert auch für Deutschland. Und wenn Sie bereits Abonnent sind, dann möchte ich mich an dieser Stelle einfach mal bei Ihnen bedanken und wünsche Ihnen nun viel Vergnügen beim nächsten Video.